I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A 2017 explosion that killed a man at one of the country's largest ammunition plants was ruled an accident. Now a KCUR reporter has learned of a second explosion that long went unreported. Today, the secrecy around the Lake City ammunition plant in Independence. It had numerous safety violations and paid hefty fines. We'll ask if cost-cutting measures there are putting workers at risk. Then, the Kansas City stockyards were once a melting pot of diversity, and the industry established there helped propel Kansas City into the modern age. We'll take a look at how our cow town was transformed into an industrialized city. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We know that Lawrence Bass Jr. died in an explosion, and we know this happened at the Lake City Army Ammunition Plant out in Independence. But after that, we know little more. In part, that's because the Army, which owns the Lake City facility, and Northrop Grumman, which runs the ammunition plant, declined interview requests for a just-completed story from the Guns in America Public Media Reporting Project based here at KCUR. So the Lawrence Bass Jr. mystery lingers. But Guns in America discovered that the ammunition plant run by Northrop Grumman suffered from a worker safety record far worse than its peers, and a federal agency that investigated uncovered a series of safety concerns. Chris Haxel's reporter with KCUR, who works on the Guns in America Public Media Reporting Project that focuses on the role of guns in American life, he wrote the story on Lawrence Bass's death that you can now see at kcur.org. Chris, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
How did you get interested in this story to begin with, Chris?
Well, I arrived here in town last fall and, you know, was just kind of doing research related to my Guns in America beat. I pretty quickly picked up on this ammunition plant and the fact that it's the largest in the country. And so I was just kind of poking around a little bit, saw these old news reports related to this explosion from a couple years ago, and started filing records requests.
I was going to say, I was just struck by how much secrecy surrounds this explosion at the Lake City facility back in 2017. You couldn't get comment from some of the key players. You couldn't get your hands on investigative reports from the Army and the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives that agency completed. Mm-hmm. Why so much secrecy here? Any idea?
I mean, anytime you've got a government facility, especially related to the military, they're always going to be, wanting to avoid talking about it. It's not clear to me how much, if any, of the work they do is actually classified, technically. But they just didn't want to answer questions about it. Now, partially that might be related to pending litigation. To my knowledge, Northrop Grumman has not been sued, so I'm not sure, if they're just concerned about litigation, but, they just didn't really want to talk about it.
You know, tell us about the Lake City Army Ammunition Plant in Independence. This is a pretty significant place in terms of what it does for the military because it makes a lot of bullets. In fact, it produces as many as 2 billion rounds a year.
Right. This plant is the military's sole provider of small caliber ammunition. So what that means is 5.56 millimeter, which is the round fired by an M16 or an M4. If you just picture soldiers or Marines with rifles, they fire the 5.56. They also produce 7.62 and 50 caliber rounds there. Those are more typically used in light or heavy machine guns. But at least 90%, probably more than 90% of the military's ammunition is produced at Lake City.
I gather it would go without saying that this could be dangerous work, right? You're built making bullets.
Well, yes and no. On one hand, it's not as dangerous as you might think because the industry-wide statistics that have been compiled by the Department of Labor show that ammunition manufacturing in general is no more dangerous than other forms of manufacturing. At the same time, this facility does have a history of explosions and fires, and some of those have injured or killed workers before this one.
So what happened in this 2017 explosion? I mean, how did Lawrence Bass die? What do we know?
So he was mixing an explosive called tetrazine. That is one of the ingredients in the primer mix. So if you consider a bullet, basically the primer is what ignites the gunpowder, and the gunpowder is what sends the bullet out of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And so this primer is present in very small amounts in each cartridge, but when you make 2 billion bullets a year, you've got a lot of primer material. So this is a high explosive. Mr. Bass was removing some of this tetrazine had just been manufactured. They make it on site. It was going through a drying process before it could go to the next
phase.
He was
using a spatula, like maybe you'd find in the kitchen?
Yeah, it's some sort of plastic material. And it, frankly, that's part of the problem is, you know, what the investigation revealed was that it's not clear where exactly the spatula came from or who made it. It seems like it was custom made, but nobody knows its origin.
Was anybody else injured that day?
There were four other workers injured. I believe they were, you know, they did not suffer serious injuries, but the, you know, the Army and Lake City declined to talk about that.
Now, you've learned of a second explosion that long went unreported. What can you tell us about that?
Right. So that was, to be fair, a much smaller explosion. It happened in a, sort of a neighboring building in a related part of the manufacturing process. A different primer material was being produced. There was a leaky faucet, apparently, which was sort of dropping some raw materials together that shouldn't have been together. And so it caused a small explosion. Nobody was injured. But yeah, it went unreported, according to some of the records I've obtained. You know, the company wasn't forthright with investigators about this happening. They had to find out from anonymous complaints from an employee.
Hmm. Now, a couple just work structural things here. Lawrence Bass worked for Orbital ATK,
yep,
which ran the plant, right? Do I have that right?
Correct.
And Orbital was later bought by Northrop.
Right.
A year or two ago.
Right.
Okay. And Orbital apparently suffered from a lousy worker safety record. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, the ammunition plant industry as a whole doesn't have a super high problem with workplace injuries. But according to some of the documents I obtained, I calculated this plant in particular, its average in the 5 years before the explosion was about 3.5 times higher than its industry peers.
Okay. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a 2017 explosion at the Lake City Army Ammunition Plant out in Independence. My guest is Chris Haxel. He's a reporter with KCUR who works on the Guns and America Public Media Reporting Project. Okay, the ATF here ruled after the accident that it was indeed accidental, but you say that a series of subsequent investigations found safety concerns that may have caused the blast. Fill us in there.
Yeah, so that's a series of investigations by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
And they come in and they investigate when something goes wrong like this.
Right, right. And to be fair, you know, OSHA's role in all of this is not to find the cause of the explosion or the cause of the incident. It's to find workplace safety violations. And so that's what they went in looking for. They found, you know, they ended up finding violations related to that second explosion, but on this explosion in particular, most of what they found were problems with the standard operating procedures. Those are, of course, written rules that explain in step-by-step detail how workers should do their job. It's important to have good SOPs in any industry, but when you're dealing with high explosives, you know, it's super important.
Yeah.
And so basically, you know, that spatula you mentioned earlier, that spatula was not even mentioned in the SOPs for this stage of the manufacturing process, even though, you know, workers told OSHA investigators that they'd been using that spatula for at least 15 years.
And what you found was that potentially that spatula could cause a problem when it comes to a premature explosion of some kind.
Right, right. So this material, tetrazine, again, it's a high explosive, and it's being, at this stage in the manufacturing process, it's being dried. So when it's first made in a reactor on site, it's pretty wet. It has maybe like a cake batter consistency, but they need to dry it because if it's going to be an explosive that gets put into an ammunition cartridge, it can't be wet because it won't ignite. And so they need to find the sweet spot where it's dry enough
and
to ignite.
It can't be too dry because then it gets dangerous.
Right, right. The drier it is, though, the more volatile it becomes. And so if it gets too dry, then, you know, actions which could on another day be totally normal and not cause any problems could ignite an explosion if it's too dry.
Okay, now layered on top of all this is this notion that Orbital ATK was eager, apparently, to cut costs. What was happening with that part of this story?
Yeah, about 6 months before the explosion, Orbital ATK made an announcement on Wall Street that they had basically screwed up their financial reportings and that they couldn't file their quarterly earnings report on time.
And that's a big deal.
It's a huge deal. I mean, their stock plummeted more than 20% that day alone. And a few weeks later, the lawsuits started coming in, and we're starting to see some of those lawsuits settled or adjudicated now. And basically what happened is Orbital ATK had run Lake City since 2000, but in the year 2012, their contract with the military was up to be rebid. And the company really wanted to keep that contract, and so they submitted a really low bid. They got the contract, but over the course of the 7 years or 8 years of the contract, they were expecting, at least according to their public, their new financial reporting, expected to lose about $375 million on that contract.
Hmm. The federal government wound up, Chris, levying fines after that second explosion. What kinds of fines? Do you have any sense of how much those were for?
If you combine the three OSHA investigations into the first explosion, the second explosion, and then a third one related to some lead that workers were being exposed to, OSHA ended up fining the company a little over $100,000.
Is that considered to be a lot?
Yes and no. OSHA is, for these types of violations, OSHA's statutory maximum at the time was about $13,000 per violation. So if you do the math, they're fining them almost as much as they're allowed to. So by OSHA standards, that's significant.
You know, you asked some hard questions in your piece, Chris, and one of them was this. Should the plant have been using a different, safer manufacturing process? What did you find out?
Well, there are other processes that other companies, other factories across the country use. When we're talking again about drying this tetrazine, which is a high explosive, you can't let it get too dry though. And so the method that Orbital ATK was using was essentially they'd put it in a vacuum receiver for a few hours and they'd suck the moisture out of this material. What other places do is they basically just let it sit there. They let it sit there for a while, and so some just dries by evaporation. So if you think about maybe the difference between hanging clothes on a clothesline versus a dryer.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least one worker told OSHA investigators in the wake of the explosion that the company had changed its manufacturing processes to more closely mirror what these other companies are doing. I asked the company and I asked the Army, are you guys actually still doing this? Did you make any other changes? And they wouldn't say.
Another tough question that you asked here, did cost-cutting measures at the company wind up endangering workers? What do you know about that?
Well, to be clear, Northrop Grumman didn't agree to an interview request. They didn't agree to answer any questions, but they did issue a statement, standing by the workplace safety record. One guy I did talk to for the story is a former plant manager. He left shortly before the explosion, but he was running the joint for about 5 years before it happened. And he strongly defended their workplace safety record. He said they had meetings every week, discussing every significant injury that happened.
Now, the production contract that Northrop Grumman currently holds is being rebid right now. Mm-hmm. Why is that happening?
Yeah, so when the original contract was signed in 2012, it was set to start in 2013, and it was going to be a 7-year contract automatically. But then they have these sort of additional years that if both parties agree, then they can continue those for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Typically, that does happen because both parties, don't want to have to go through the rebidding process. In this case, since Orbital ATK, now Northrop Grumman, was losing so much money on this contract, they notified the Army, hey, we went out early. And so the contract is set to expire in 2020.
Okay. The other thing you came across is that a worker at the plant, a woman named Christina Sevi, had identified safety issues at the plant, including one that concerned the compound that exploded and killed Lawrence Bass. Tell me about Christina Sevi.
So she basically came in and started identifying some of these problems that investigators with OSHA later identified. We've talked a lot about how the moisture content of this tetrazine is important. Well, it turns out they weren't actually testing the moisture content before they would let workers handle it. So they would test it, send it to a lab. The results might not come back for a few hours or until the next day. But Christina Sevi came in and said basically, hey, there's this machine that could give us the results in 15 minutes. Why don't we use that so they can get the results? Then they'll know if they're dealing with, you know, an unsafe level here.
But her recommendation wasn't followed?
Well, it was followed. It took quite a while for her to get approval to purchase the machine. It's not clear to me whether that's because there were, you know, hesitation about the expense or you're just talking your typical red tape. They did get the machine a few months before the explosion, but they hadn't yet finalized their procedures or finalized their processes with that machine. They basically were still calibrating it.
Do you have any sense, Chris, is Northrop going to have competition for this production contract going forward? Is it likely?
Almost certainly. I did contact a couple other defense contracting companies that have bid on this in the past to ask. I didn't hear back from them, possibly because they just don't want to say. But yeah, I mean, a contract this big, this is, you know, a multi-billion-dollar contract more than likely. And so multiple companies are likely to be competing with Northrop Grumman.
Maybe a key question here. What do we know about whether the family of Lawrence Bass was ever compensated for his death at the plant?
It's not clear whether they have received any compensation. There is pending litigation, so the family filed a federal lawsuit a couple weeks ago, actually, against the U.S. government.
I gather the family's not talking?
Correct.
Okay. This didn't make it into your story, but you told us that the Army is close to finalizing a plan to start making a new type of ammunition in Lake City for a completely new rifle. What do you know about that and about rumors that a new facility could, in fact, be in the works here?
Right. So the Army has plans to basically get rid of or replace the 5.56 millimeter bullet we talked about earlier with a new 6.8 millimeter bullet. Basically, they just felt like the smaller bullet didn't have enough stopping power as soldiers fought the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they want a bullet with a little more oomph. And so they have the Army has said it's going to be building that bullet at Lake City. They've issued some contracts for like preliminary design plans and that sort of thing, but nothing formal has been announced.
Okay, that's Chris Haxel. He's a reporter with KCUR who works on the Guns and America Public Media Reporting Project. You can see his very good story on Lawrence Bassus's death at kcur.org. Chris, thanks for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the stockyards in Kansas City and how Kansas City was brought into the modern era. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we observed the impact that Henry Block had on our community. Hear stories from those impacted by his contributions to the city he loved. You'll find that segment at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the indie film critics are back. We'll get their thoughts on the documentary, indie, and foreign films that you shouldn't miss. Well, think of Kansas City's early days, and you might think of Native Americans and pioneers and cowboys tossing some cattle and other livestock, and you're all set. But the Kansas City stockyards wasn't really so much about that popular image. Historian John Heron says the stockyards really were more about basic American industrialization. John writes about this in an essay published in a new book, Wide Open Town, Kansas City in the Pendergast Era. One of his conclusions, the multi-ethnic stockyards workforce gave a young Kansas City a distinctive flavor. John Heron is associate dean in the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences and a professor of history. He was on our show yesterday talking about his book on Henry Block. This is an unusually rare back-to-back appearance. John, nice to have you again.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, you point out here that Kansas City was late to the meatpacking game, so I was wondering, how did our town manage to emerge as such a major player in the cattle business.
So it's very connected to the railroads. We can date the early stockyards to the 1870s. Matter of fact, 1870 exactly, where there were about 5 or 6 acres in the West Bottoms that were scoped out to be the immediate to be the first stockyard. But growth was pretty quick. From that 1870 beginning, by 1874, we have Charles Adams, the famous Adams family in Boston. He's the grandson and great-grandson of American presidents. He partners with a few Chicago developers, and the meatpacking industry in Kansas City was off and running.
You argue that this massive meat operation here wound up transforming Kansas City from a Western cow town with its longhorn cattle and cowboys on horseback to a city every bit as industrialized as other leading American cities at the time. And it was this push towards industry that propelled Kansas City into the modern age. Explain that to us.
Yeah, I agree. I think when people think about Kansas City, the typical cliches of Kansas City, it's a Western town. The cowboys, the cattle, leather, the wide open plains, that is what people think of when they think Kansas City. But a more accurate picture is probably to think about livestock processing in the same way we think about steel or coal. And it is not necessarily the wide open spaces of Kansas City that made it unique. It was the industrial labor force that was every much Detroit and Pittsburgh, not Abilene and Wichita.
Because it was so highly regimented. It was regimented. That's just the way it worked.
Yeah, exactly. So the stockyards in Kansas City were Kansas City's first $1 million a year industry, first $1 million a month industry, and first $1 million a day industry. So this was big business on an industrial scale using modern industrial techniques and efficient technologies, and especially labor. It's not men on horseback that we think of, that we should think of when we think Kansas City. It is wage laborers working in fairly harsh conditions that make this town much more of an industrial scene.
Fairly harsh might be putting it a little mildly after reading your essay. I mean, this could be really difficult, at least for some of the workers involved here.
Yeah, and I guess, we could probably extend that to most of the workers. The work was nasty. It is assembly line style work. You are processing, a live animal, obviously, so you're often hunched over. The conditions of arthritis and the other sort of just basic injuries that come from a working life of these difficult conditions. But it's also speed. This is a very fast process. Workers would have seconds to perform any number of deheading a cow, for example, was supposed to take 8 seconds. To debristle a hog was supposed to take 2 seconds. But you're also working around knives and saws and cleavers. So the working conditions were very intense. It was very regulated in terms of speed. The work itself was very dangerous. And you're doing this in Kansas City. So imagine it's 105 degrees in August and, you're working. There's this just brutal working conditions. It's hot. There's blood.
A lot of blood.
Yes. Yeah, there's some great quotes about workers talking about working ankle deep in blood, or just being some workers would strip themselves to the waist because of the heat and then just be covered in blood within minutes of the shift beginning. So you can imagine what this is like.
You say that the workforce here wound up altering the history of labor activism in the Midwest. That's a big statement. What happened?
Well, some of that is just because of the multi-ethnic character of the workforce in Kansas City. So if you look at the roster of employees that work in all the big packing houses, it is like a United Nations. There are workers from Ireland, France, Germany, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, Italians, but also Australians, Canadians, Indians, Japanese, and the Chinese. And then, of course, in Kansas City, we had this massive influx of Eastern Europeans, which we can still see in the heritage of places like Strawberry Hill. It's Russian, Bulgarian, Polish, and, of course, Czech, Slovak, and Croat. But in many ways, the most significant cohort, the most significant component of that working force were African Americans. So at least 25% of the labor force was black. In some houses, that would climb to as high as 40%. And what that multi-ethnic, multi-racial labor force created a unique political environment in which there was more voice given to minorities in the workforce in Kansas City than probably any other comparable city.
And a lot of these folks, African Americans included, concluded that working there was actually not a bad job.
Yeah, and some of that reflects Kansas City. So in the early 20th century, if you're an African American laborer, there's not a lot of choices for you. They're going to pay a decent or living wage. You could be a porter on the railroad, which a lot of African American men did do. You could be a female domestic. But outside of that, there weren't a lot of opportunities besides the, you know, sporadic manual labor. But the packing houses were a significant source of employment. And the belief was that the packing houses were benevolent and they treated their employees well, and that African Americans did gravitate to the packing houses in large numbers.
I was going to say, you can't help but wonder, John, how did everybody get along?
Well, and this is
in this melting pot of industrialization that was in the west bottoms of our town.
Yeah, and this is one of the interesting things you can read. So Kansas City in the early 20th century had a number of African American newspapers. And while those newspapers do not always were not always an independent voice of the black community, they did speak a lot about how packing house workers, if a packing house supported a cultural event, it was often the largest unsegregated event in what was a very segregated city. And the key thing is we can sort of follow how this develops through a series of some very prominent strikes in Kansas City, labor disputes, and how those unfolded in ways that I found kind of unexpected.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, like for example, labor politics came to the stockyards as early as the 1890s. We get some early laboring groups, the Knights of Labor and the American Federation of Labor. But there's a pretty major strike in 1904. Mm-hmm. 7,000 stockyard workers, both black and white, walk off the job. And the strike unfolded exactly how as we'd expect. Workers strike, demanding better pay, better working conditions. Owners begin importing strike breakers. The strike spreads to other meatpacking cities, Omaha, St. Louis, Chicago. And in the end, the 1904 strike in Kansas City was a dismal failure for the union. And we see in the national press union leaders from across the country often blaming African-American stockyard workers for the failure of this strike, but not in Kansas City. In Chicago, we see an uptick in racial hostility after this the strike fails. The Chicago newspapers carry story after story about how racial conflict was everywhere, and they largely blame African-American workers. But in Kansas City, and this is going to sound a little counterintuitive, we have black strikers who are often in conflict with black strike breakers who are brought into the city. And so I don't think many people would see black-on-black violence as evidence of racial harmony. But strangely, in Kansas City, it's proof that African-Americans in the stockyards had some standing. They were a force to be reckoned with. And so black meatpacking workers would ally with their white colleagues against the company or against these black strikebreakers in a way that there was common cause between the races that was unique to Kansas City.
I don't want to give away too much, but if you do fast forward to 1938, there's another major strike with a very different outcome. Tell us about
that. Yeah, that strike was also very interesting. And I think strikes become a way to kind of peer into this story a little bit. So that strike was Armour, you know, the largest meatpacking firm in Kansas City. Without consulting their workers, they raised the kill. And the kill was the daily quota for how many animals needed to be processed.
So you had to work faster.
Right, exactly. And there was no raise in pay. It was just, we need to process more animals. And six hide seller workers, five African-Americans and one Croatian worker, went to their union stewards to complain. Now, a hide seller worker is one of the worst jobs in the plant. The cow comes in, it's struck with a sledgehammer, it's rendered unconscious, then a slitter or a deheader then slices the throat of the cow and the cow bleeds out. And then it goes to the men who took the hide off, mm-hmm. Working with knives in both hands. They took the valuable hide off the animal, and then they took that hide and they slid it down a chute into the basement of the processing plant. And there, in very dark, very humid conditions, these hide workers process those skins, salted them, stretched them.
That would not be a good job.
Yeah, God, it was a terrible job.
Yeah.
Largely reserved for African Americans or these fresh arrivals from Eastern Europe. So these five African Americans and one Croatian worker attended a hearing with the company complaining about the fact that the kill had been raised. The very next day, their petition was denied and their pay was docked for the time that they spent complaining to company officials. The day after that, the entire company goes out on strike.
Man.
So the entire workforce goes on strike basically to protect the interests of five African-American hide seller workers. 1,000 workers take over the plant, including 400 African-Americans. And what is very unusual, the union wins. Hmm. The grand total was $22 in back pay for these six employees, and the company agrees to pay it. But more than that, they established the power of these African-American workers and the union. So it was quite remarkable that the lowest rung of these yes. stockyard workers were able to stand against the company.
We're talking about a new book, Wide Open Town, Kansas City in the Pendergast Era. It's a series of essays. John Heron, an associate dean at the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, writes about the stockyards, the industrialization there, and how it brought Kansas City into the modern age. He'll be speaking about all this at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. You know, this essay that you wrote brought back a pretty sharp memory to me, because when I first came to town in 1986, you could still get a pretty strong whiff of those stockyards down there blowing up into downtown streets. And of course, it all disappeared in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. But people who have been around this town for a while, that heritage of stockyards was with us, you know, not that many years ago.
Yeah, 1991 is the last livestock sale. And the heritage, obviously, is everywhere. I think what's a little unusual is, given the massive footprint that the stockyards had in the West Bottoms, how little evidence there is that it ever existed. Matter of fact, I've driven through the area looking for evidence.
The best thing is the Livestock Exchange building.
The building is still there. And again, at its peak, the Livestock Exchange building was the largest building in the world dedicated to commercial livestock exchanges. So, I mean, it is a massive building and a testament to how large this operation was. But it's basically been wiped clean. There's no... there's some debate about there's some concrete steps that are in the West Bottoms or something, but you can't really see much evidence of this massive industrial footprint that was in Kansas City.
Any sense of why that is?
That's a good question, and I don't know. I mean, some of it is now. It's pretty valuable real estate that's you know, undergoing a transition. Some of it was the buildings themselves were pretty ephemeral. I mean, it's, you know, massive amounts of corrals and fences in these buildings that are all gone. But the legacy is even beyond the West Bottoms. It's Armourdale, it's Argentine. I mean, all these neighborhoods were planned for stockyard workers. I mean, Armourdale is because of the Armour Packing Company.
Yeah.
Even if the physical evidence is gone, certainly the legacy is long and deep.
You know, it's amazing to me to look back on just how important meatpacking was to this town, John. In 1900, you write that meatpacking represented, and this number is staggering, 91% of the city's total industrial output. I mean, 91%.
Yeah, this was a one industry.
That's almost 100.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is, this is why I want you to think Detroit and automobiles and Pittsburgh and steel. This was a one industry town, and it was dominated by livestock. And it's kind of hard to fathom now, given the dispersed nature of livestock production in the United States. But yeah, Kansas City benefited because the big meatpacking center, of course, is Chicago. But by the time Kansas City is rising, Chicago was space trapped. I mean, they couldn't really. Chicago was growing. The stockyards, the Union stockyards in Chicago, were kind of located in an area of the city where they couldn't expand. Kansas City had the advantage that they could just keep adding acres and acres and acres and growing and growing and growing.
Yeah.
So Kansas City quickly became second only to Chicago, and had this it made the city hum. We see evidence it was a tourist attraction. So the stockyards had tours for people coming in. The railroads advertised special tours of the slaughterhouses.
You could go into the slaughterhouse?
You could. And they had viewing platforms. And this was especially early on when it was maybe a little bit more low-key. But they would warn women about, well, your hair is probably going to get a little messed up and you might get some splatters on your dress. Was a tourist, definitely a tourist attraction. When, you know, the big political conventions were in town in the 20s, all the officials would go to the stockyards.
That's amazing.
And again, it would have been... again, not to put too fine a point on it, but it just would have been the smell would have been horrific.
Well, the smell in downtown back even in the 80s was pretty rough. You know?
Well, you can imagine. I mean, the numbers are staggering. By 1900, the United States, the Kansas City stockyards are processing, you know, 5 million animals a year. By 1918, that number is, you know, sky high. And just that many animals coming through every day. So not only is the actual process of deconstructing this animal, but, you know, a single cow can produce as much as 50 or 60 pounds of manure a day. Like, what are you going to do with all that stuff?
And a lot of it went in the river, to be honest, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. And there was a battle between KCK and KC Moe about, you know, who is polluting whom, and how. Yeah, we just dumped it in the river, just, you know, out of sight, out of mind.
You know, there was a lot of money to be made in all this, and I'm wondering who was making it.
So the big companies, the companies that are in many ways still involved in this industry today. So Armour, of course, is still a major player. Swift, Kudahy, Reed and Reed. There were. You know, the major Chicago Packers all had offices here in Kansas City. So the money that was being made, you know, surprising, is coming to the corporate structure that supported it. But the railroads made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. The Livestock Exchange building had its own banking network. So it was a very robust industry that was making a lot of people a lot of money. Probably not a lot of money to the people who are doing the actual work, and that's no surprise to anybody. But the Kansas City stockyards seem to pay a reasonable price, even to livestock growers in the Midwest. So it was a pretty attractive destination.
I'm wondering how all this money made Kansas City a better town. Do you have any feel for that, John?
Well, and again, we can use the African American workers as another example. So when you have a robust working population like the African Americans who are working in the stockyards and they are making a living wage or something close to it, what we see at the same time that African Americans are expanding their foothold in labor politics in the stockyards, they're also building a pretty vibrant culture in Kansas City. So we see everything that we now take for granted as part of African American culture. We see jazz clubs, we see sports teams, we see black-owned businesses, protective associations, churches. This is all made possible by the infusion of wages paid by the stockyards. It also, that ethnic diversity. I mean, Kansas City is a city of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Some of those neighborhoods have very distinctive ethnic flavors, and some of that too, even today, is a reflection of the diverse ethnicities that were brought into the stockyards. So if Kansas City was in fact a wide open town, the stockyards were in fact a key part of that, of the reason why.
That's really interesting. Again, John Heron's been my guest. He's an associate dean in the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He was on our show yesterday talking about Henry Block as well. The new book in which John's essay appears is titled Wide Open Town, Kansas City in the Pendergast Era. He'll be speaking again at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at the Central Library. That's the 114 West 10th Street downtown. You can find more information about that at kclibrary.org. John, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for filling us in.
Thank you so
Appreciate
much.
Appreciate it. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. We Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish to talk about some cool stuff to do on your weekend. And nice to see you again. Welcome
it's
back.
It's nice to be seen.
It's time to do it again.
Let's do it.
Talk about great stuff to do on the weekend. Who do we got here?
Another weekend of fun and games and goodness knows what
right
else
awaits
us.
Right here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Right here in KC. Well, on the Missouri and the Kansas side.
Yes.
We try to share the love. Okay. Michael Schenker Fest. That's Michael Schenker. He's such a big name in the hard rock metal guitar scene, he has his own fest.
Okay.
And so Michael Schenker...
I didn't know he was that big of a name.
Well, here's
I don't know Michael Schenker.
Well, you know, it's not surprising that you say that to me for a number of reasons.
Well,
but,
yes, probably a bunch.
But I'll give you this. For some people, seeing Michael Schenker head his own fest, the former Scorpions guitarist, the former UFO guitarist, the former lead man of the Michael Schenker group.
Huh.
For a lot of people, this is a big deal.
Okay.
Because
I'm going to take your word for it.
Well, no. I'll give you
not
a little
in my
more.
Neighborhood, but you're saying for other people it is, and I'll accept that.
For the rest of a lot, but for the rest of us, you can still experience a world-class way to be rocked the hard way. What I'm trying to say, Steve, is that when you show up, if you do show up at 7:30 Sunday at the Truman. Right, if you do
right
that.
Right downtown.
If my urgings are somewhat successful, even if your eyes don't roll into the back of your head during Michael Schenker's fierce guitar barrage, here's what's in store. The Michael Schenker Fest. This was the guy who played guitar for the Scorpions in the 70s, right?
Okay.
UFO,
Scorpions,
Michael Schenker.
UFO. I've heard of him, but
right, so
I'm not familiar.
Those out there who can feel their palms getting sweaty right now, here's what you're going to get. The Michael Schenker Fest reunites all three or four, perhaps, of the Michael Schenker Group original singers. They're going to play a retrospective of all of these greatest hits. You get Gary Barden, Graham Bonnet, Robin McCauley. Those are the three big singers who've made so many of Michael's, if not hits, at least deep, groovy album cuts so popular with fans.
Okay.
Well, there you are.
That sounds exciting.
I think it does.
I've got a Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got a 12-sided die. I've got Kitty Pryde and Nightcrawler too. Waiting there for me, yes I do. I do.
And speaking of hard rock, we've got some right here.
Well, no. Here's the thing. Kitty Pryde, if you're listening to the words of this fine In the Garage song by Weezer, where do geeks go? They go to the garage.
Okay.
They look at their posters of Kitty Pryde and Nightcrawler, members of the X-Men, as I'm sure you secretly understand, but don't really want to brag about on the air. Or they have their Kiss posters up. I'll give you that.
You're talking about an alternative universe from mine.
Well, that's actually what I'm talking about, Steve, is a nostalgic alternative universe.
Okay.
But let's move on to the modern geek. How should we put this? Is a nerd a geek? Is a geek a nerd?
Yeah, sort of.
All right, here we go. Geekcraft Expo KC. This is where you go, or you tell your friends who are so inclined, to go check out the handmade, geek-themed craft market, including artwork, all handmade. Not, well, maybe by geeks, certainly for geeks, including artwork, apparel, accessories, playthings, home decorations, furniture. Cosplay is highly encouraged. It's 10 to 5 Saturday.
At Bartle Hall.
And 10 to 4 Sunday at Bartle Hall. Here's where perhaps there is some confusion. Technically, geek, if you look it up, means, quote, unfashionable or socially inept, right?
Okay.
No more. No. Geekdom is now mainstream. I mean, you know how much money the Avengers Endgame movie is going to make when it opens this weekend?
A whole lot.
Yeah, and I'd say half the people going 30 years ago would be labeled geeks. And now they wear that proudly. That is a flag to fly. So go enjoy Geekcraft Expo.
And somewhere in my mind there's a painting box. I have the red colors, but it's true. Just lately when I...
This is a fun event you're going to talk about right now.
Well, there are pictures to be drawn and pictures to be appreciated.
And the Art Institute of Kansas City's got all of that.
Every year, about this time,
it's
time again for the Kansas City Art Institute's illustration end of semester show.
You can get some good stuff.
It's a pop-up shop. It's an exhibition, right? It features work by sophomores and juniors and seniors, illustration students. Many, if not most pieces, will be available for purchase. This is happening all weekend long. The public is heartily invited. 5 to 8 Friday evening, 10 to 5 Saturday, noon to 5 Sunday. Yes, at the Kansas City Art Institute. Now, what do you think it costs to be a student at the Art Institute, tuition and fees?
Yeah.
Take a wild guess.
I'm going to make a wild guess.
For, and actually, this is the truth. I looked it up. $38,000 and some change
is
was...
that right?
That's what it basically... Well, that's not even that's not even counting housing. But the point is this. Some of those young people
that
have...
That doesn't count housing?
No. Student tuition and fees, $38,000 and something. Anyway, that's... Well, it's, I'm sure it's worth every shekel. But scholarships aside, and some kids do get help... I am sure there's more than a few students who could probably use some assistance if we showed up, you and me, Steve, and purchased some of their artwork. And since everything is negotiable, that also means you don't have to pay full price. So don't be afraid to bargain.
I've been a-grubbin' on a little farm on the flat and windy plains. I've been a-listening to the hungry cattle bawl. I'm gonna pack my wife and kids. I'm gonna hit that western road. I'm gonna hit that Oregon trail this coming fall.
You're going to explain why Woody Guthrie is singing to us right now.
I will, because you've just told me to do that.
Okay,
so here we go. Well, now, Woody Guthrie, way back when, he's singing a song about the Oregon Trail. Now, he's probably referring to that Dust Bowl 1930s, 40s thing and how a lot of people are going to get in their jalopies and try to seek a better fortune.
Okay.
They're going to go west and get on the Oregon Trail.
They didn't have jalopies back in those days, did they?
In the 30s.
Oh, in the 30s,
1930s.
Okay.
But let's go back to the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. You know...
No jalopies then.
Well, no, not engine-powered, but they say perhaps up to 400,000 pioneers traversed the Oregon Trail way back when.
And so what's going to happen here?
Well, what's going to happen here is we're going to remember it's called Live Action Oregon Trail, in which the public, families it sounds like, can show up. They can form four-member teams, and they will be vying to, quote, survive the Oregon Trail with a gauntlet of games and trivia and relay races, 10 to 4 Saturday. Go to the National Frontier Trails Museum in Independence and try not to get dysentery.
And finally today...
Once I had a little dog, I called him Cracker Jack. He had a spot around one eye that looked just like a patch. His legs were...
Oh, I could listen to Dolly all day.
Okay.
She can write them, can't she?
She can sing them.
Yes, she can.
Okay,
all
so
that.
Cracker Jack and Snickers and Fido and all the other dogs that are out there, they're all invited to Fountain City Dogs at Play. There's a couple of events. It's basically a meetup for pooches to learn to mingle and play nice together, but maybe their masters could learn a little bit from the dogs. Okay, real quick, 7 o'clock Friday, go to the Barquet Restaurant Bar, Coffee House, and Dog Park. You can find it. It's 7 o'clock Friday. It's called Barks and Brews. It's really like a Disneyland for dogs. Very social animals. Now, if you want to go 1 p.m. Saturday, then you must bring a small dog on his play date. It's at Bentley's Pet Stuff in Overland Park, and these are for shy dogs and shy owners who want the dogs to get along better.
And that's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
I'll see you at the Avengers.
Tomorrow on the show, legal analyst Joan Biskupic and her biography of the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.